From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Whether your bracket is broken, bent, or unblemished, there are many reasons to heed the hardwood happenings this weekend. Ahead on Only a Game, our experts pick the men's and women's winners. Also, a 2007 Major League Baseball season preview and a conversation with Joe Posnanski, author of The Soul of Baseball, A Road Trip Through Buck O'Neill's America. Also ahead, why the top executive of the NHL's Minnesota Wild turned to a young baseball writer for front office help.
I think it was another set of eyes. You know, the question then is, why my set versus somebody who's more experienced around hockey? I think he viewed my inexperience and my lack of institutional knowledge about how a hockey team is run as a plus.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Old Patrick Ewing's happy, and he's not the only one. The folks who call Ohio home are having lots of fun. The Gators out of Florida are back to bite again, and UCLA is reminding us of way back when John Wooden coached the winner every year and called for more. We've reached the weekend when it's time to watch the Final Four. Joining me now on the line from Atlanta to discuss the 2007 Men's Final Four is ESPN's Pat Forty. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Bill. I'm inspired by your verse.
Well, you're one of the very few people, I'm sure. But in any case, this evening, Georgetown will play Ohio State for the right to advance to the finals. Most of the talk seems to center around those teams' big men. Are we about to witness a contest of the colossi for the ages?
I think it's very possible. You know, we're looking at two guys that will probably play 10 or 15 years in the NBA eventually, Greg Oden and Roy Hibbert. We've gone many, many years without seeing these guys dominate in college before. And now they're back in spades here playing against each other, both very skilled, very aggressive, great defensive players, so they may limit each other. And really, you know, in that sort of situation, I could see a guy like Jeff Green, who's only 6'9", for Georgetown, ending up being the big man on the court.
Well, Oden's ability or inability to stay out of foul trouble generally seems to determine how effective Ohio State can be. Will he be able to stay out of foul trouble against Hibbert?
Great question, because that's, you know, he is a very aggressive shot blocker. He reaches in on guys going for the ball, so, you know, he's really going to have to play smart, I would say. And, you know, it might be an advantage to playing somebody's own size where he's not swatting down at them and at the ball, so he might be able to keep his hands out of harm's way to a degree.
Some observers are saying that despite their status as a number two seed, the Hoyas are lucky to be in the Final Four. What do you think?
No luckier than Ohio State, which I saw in person, needed a three-pointer with 2 seconds left to tie Xavier and go into overtime in the second round. So, you know, I think both teams have had their near misses in this tournament. Obviously, the Georgetown one with Vanderbilt, but most teams end up having a game like that somewhere along the way onto a Final Four, and I wouldn't call it luck for either side.
Later tonight, Florida takes on UCLA in a rematch of the 2006 final. UCLA has got the defense. Florida has the depth. Do you agree that this game is intriguing for those reasons, and maybe there are more reasons, too?
Oh, yes. I think there are many reasons. Certainly those two that you mentioned, but also the fact that they played a year ago in the title game and Florida absolutely routed UCLA. I think being the underdog almost sets a team free, and I could see UCLA being able to play with a great deal less pressure on them. Obviously, I think that this will be a closer game than that. It's very reminiscent, actually, of 1990 and 91 when Duke was crushed by UNLV in the final and then came back and upset them in the semifinals the next year in a great game. I don't see UCLA winning, but I do see a close game.
Does the world really hate Florida as their star Joakim Noah claims, or is this just standard locker room motivational trash talking?
Yeah, that's all it is. It's boilerplate us against the world stuff, which, you know, these days that seems to go a long way for guys. They nobody wants the respect. They all just complain about not getting it. but I don't see them as being anywhere near as unloved as, say, Duke is by some people. You know, the fact is, last year they were a fresh story, and this year they're not so fresh, and so there's probably some people that are tired of them winning, but I don't see them as hated, no.
There have been basketball celebrity sightings throughout this tournament. No surprise, this is a big draw. But John Thompson, John Wooden, Danny Ainge, Bill Walton, Adolph Rupp, Yoda, the ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi, I think, was spotted last week. Who's next?
Great question. This being Atlanta, maybe we'll have Hammer and Hank Aaron in the stands or something. You know, there are an amazing number of players here or coaches here who have famous relatives, fathers and mothers, that sort of thing, that the bloodlines are awfully strong in this tournament.
You know, Pat, everybody for entertainment purposes only, of course, gets involved in the brackets for these tournaments, and we at Only a Game are supposed to be experts, and our brackets are all in utter shambles. You know, I think somebody who doesn't know a basketball from a, you know, cassava melon is winning the pool at this point. What about yourself? Did you have some brackets, and if so, what sort of shape are they in?
I'm so glad you asked, because you've just invited me to brag for once. I have all four of the Final Four.
Oh, my goodness.
I had seven of the Final Eight, and if AC Law of Texas A&M could make a layup, I would have had eight of the Final Eight because they would have beaten Memphis. So not that I'm bitter. But, no, and this is, you know, I lose to the people, the cassava melon people, every year. So this is my 1 year of revenge. I think it's like the first time in 17 years I'm actually leading the pool I'm in.
Given what you've accomplished, you are obviously the right man to ask the last question of our conversation. Who wins the semifinal games and who wins the whole thing?
Yeah, well, I better stick with what's got me here. So I'll take Florida over UCLA. I'll take Georgetown over Ohio State, and then Florida over the Hoyas on Monday night.
Pat Forte is a columnist for ESPN.com, and he talks college hoops from time to time here on Only a Game as well. Thanks again, Pat.
My pleasure.
The women's semifinals begin tomorrow in Cleveland, where number one seed North Carolina and Tennessee will battle, following a tilt between number three LSU and number four Rutgers. Joining me now on the line from Cleveland is Michelle Smith, who covers women's college basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, let's start with LSU, which made headlines a couple of weeks ago after head coach Pokey Chatman resigned amid allegations that she had had an inappropriate relationship with a former player. Now the story is the Tigers' strong play and a fourth consecutive trip to the Final Four, right?
Yeah, they've really, you know, I think that they've gained a lot of motivation maybe from their bad circumstances, and they have played really, really well.
Interim head coach Bob Starkey has helped LSU continue to play very well, despite the fact that his style is very different, not only from Chatman's, but from virtually every coach I've seen on the sidelines in either tournament.
Yes, the play everybody theory. Yeah, he is. It's very different, but I'm not sure in this case, in this short tournament time, that it's going to matter, which is not to take anything away from Bob Starkey holding that program together. But I think that at this point, when you're this deep in the season, these kids know what it is that they've been taught to do all year, and I think that they're riding a lot of emotion, and the fact that they've got one of the best players in the country in Sylvia Fowles. I think it's, you know, not really what Bob has or hasn't done at this point, but it's how he's held this all together.
Well, it is, of course, the play everybody theory, as you say, but also he's so quiet. His neck veins don't bulge. He doesn't run up and down the court screaming and shouting and incurring technical fouls.
No, he's very low-key. You know, there are some coaches who can pull that off, and apparently Bob is one of those guys. I mean, there are, you know, there are the coaches who, you know, are down on one knee pounding on the floor and screaming, and, you know, I think it's just a stylistic difference. Pokey was very energetic and very, you know, fiery on the sidelines, and he's sort of the antithesis of that. But again, I think it's been holding that group together, and maybe that demeanor goes a long way to keeping those kids calm. Maybe, you know, everything's all right. We're doing what we've been taught to do, and if he looks calm, then everybody else is good too.
LSU's opponent will be Rutgers. Rutgers head coach C. Vivian Stringer is the only coach to have brought three different programs to the Final Four, those teams being Cheney University back in 1982, Iowa in 93, and Rutgers in 2000. I have the feeling that what she'd really like on her resume is a championship.
Yeah, I think that title would be, yeah, that would be the crowning achievement for her. She is She's a great coach, and they are a very good team. And this is a team that was in and out of, at the beginning of the year, they lost to Pepperdine in over in Southern California, a team that didn't finish with anything close to a winning record. They really struggled, and they have come around very nicely, and they're really talented. I mean, T. Ajavon and Essence Carson, and this is a good team. I think, you know, and with the way they play defense, and I think they could, I think this could be a title year for Rutgers if they can get through the Tennessee juggernaut, because they think the Lady Vols are just playing out of their minds right now.
Coach Stringer had a great response to the fact that her team wasn't playing as well as she thought it should earlier in the season. She took away their sweatsuits.
Well, that, and she also brought in a bunch of their former players, star players, to come in and actually scrimmage against them and play against them and hope to sort of show them what level of play they needed to get to. It was, they were both interesting tactics.
In the later game tomorrow, UNC takes on Tennessee. It's really not fair that the number one seeded juggernauts have to play each other just to get to the finals, is it?
No, but that's the way it worked out. I mean, you know, Tennessee survived that Dayton region, which was the stacked region that everybody looked at, and then it crumbled a bit when Mississippi kind of laid waste to Maryland and then Oklahoma, and, you know, and then didn't play well against Tennessee, and I think would be disappointed in that performance. But, yeah, the two number ones, because on the other side, the seeds didn't hold up in the bracket.
You could excuse Tennessee head coach Pat Summitt for having a ho-hum attitude about a possible seventh title, which is, of course, what this one would be. But she doesn't appear to be jaded, does she?
No, I don't think it's jaded. I think it's just keeping things a little low-key. You've got teams that talk about wanting to do something special, or their talk about openly about their Final Four goals or their title aspirations. And when they don't happen, I think, you know, I think there's pressure, that self-imposed pressure, and I also think that disappointment becomes more acute. Tennessee has not won a title in a long time, but I think Pat's approach is, we're not going to go there. We're not going to spend a bunch of time talking about the title we want that we don't get. We're just going to do what we need to do to get ourselves back there, and that's what they've done.
North Carolina beat Tennessee back in December and then went undefeated for most of the rest of the regular season. What has changed for both teams since that game?
Well, at the time that North Carolina beat Tennessee, they hadn't really gone through the meat of the rigors of that ACC schedule yet, which was just, you know, between Maryland and Duke and North Carolina, is just a bruising battle in that conference. And I think Tennessee is just playing at a different level. I think Candace Parker is playing at a different level. She is, you know, Lindsey Harding may come away with some of the Player of the Year awards for her performances in those big games during the regular season, but Candace Parker is the best player in this land, and she's really playing like it in the tournament. So I think Candace elevating her game is maybe the biggest difference.
Okay, Michelle, enough with the preface portion of this conversation. It's time now for you to entertain us by predicting the final two and then, please, the final one.
Rutgers and Tennessee. Tennessee wins it all.
Oh, nuts. I was kind of hoping for Rutgers. I like to see Vivian Stringer finally win one.
I do, absolutely. But I think Pat's been denied a long time. And, you know, if you just watch them play, this looks like a team that's, you know, not going to be done until they're done. And that'll be when they're holding the trophy up.
Michelle Smith covers women's hoops for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks, Michelle, and have a good offseason.
Thank you. You too.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Naive and reckless, intoned the British Transport Police. Dangerous, stupid, and irresponsible. Great Britain's rail bobbies were referring to the man who filmed himself sliding down the longest escalator in London's underground tube network on skis. The indoor skier, who had strapped a camera to his head, later posted a 60-second video on the website YouTube. The film shows the mad fool climbing up the escalator, clipping on his skis, and careening down 200 feet while onlookers behind him shout their dismay. London Underground authorities say they'll take the strongest possible action against anyone else attempting a similar act, in case there's more than one idiot in London. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Scribe bails on baseball for a pro hockey gig. But first, because the Major League Baseball season begins tomorrow, I'm joined by ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, who is presumably tanned, rested, and ready. Hi, Tim.
I am tanned and ready. I am not rested. I never am, but that's okay. The season rejuvenates us, Bill, when games start to count again. I've had enough practice games.
Tim, I've encountered a number of intriguing propositions this spring, among them the notion that the Arizona Diamondbacks will benefit enormously from the presence of Kirk Gibson as their bench coach. Wasn't Kirk Gibson the bench coach for Alan Trammell's really, really bad Detroit Tiger teams?
Yeah, the 119-loss Detroit team, yes. I'm not believing for a second that Kirk Gibson is going to make a gigantic difference. However, I will tell you this. When you look at him, you're kind of scared anyway when you just look at him. And if you've messed up something or certainly not hustled and he's standing there waiting for you at the top step of the dugout, I'm not sure that's something you want to deal with again. So if you don't really play hard one time, I'm guessing it's going to be the last time with Kirk Gibson on that team. But again, ultimately, Bill, if the players are any good, they're going to win. And coaches, managers, bench coaches, they only have so much to do with that.
The Diamondbacks, of course, were tied for last in the National League's Western Division last time around. They got Randy Johnson back. How much does that help?
Well, I think it helps a lot because if you look at his numbers in New York, and he's considered this big bust in New York, he still won 34 games in 2 years in New York, pitching in a DH league and one of the great divisions for hitting that we've ever seen. Now he's going back to a non-DH league, which is a gigantic difference. And he's going to be pitching in the National League period, which isn't nearly the offensive league that the American League is. So if his back is healthy, and it looks like April 18th will be his first major league start, I fully expect him to win 15 more games. And you know if he wins 20 games, he wins 300 for his career. So one way or another, he's not stopping until he gets 300. And I say he gets close to it this year.
Another article that I read, this one written by one of your colleagues, maintains that there's reason for optimism among fans of the Chicago Cubs. What reason? Where?
Well, I saw the Cubs this spring, Bill, and I left after it was just an avalanche of optimism when I walked in. And everybody
your
there
presence
said,
probably explained it.
No, it wasn't me. It was them. And they were all so excited about the club. Okay, so I left thinking the Cubs, who lost 96 games last year, can win the division. They've upgraded their bullpen. They've got healthy pitchers. They've got a new manager. They got a center fielder who's going to hit 40 home runs. They're going to win the division. The very next day, I ran into a very good colleague of mine who knows way more than I do about baseball. And without even telling him where I've been, he says, "Have you seen the Cubs? Do you know how bad the Cubs are going to be?" And this is one day after I said they're going to win the division. The bottom line is this, Bill. The Cubs can win the Central because basically anybody can win the Central. And that is the theme of the National League, if not all of baseball, in 2007. We've got, I count, 24, maybe 25 teams that have a legitimate chance to make the playoffs. And the Cubs are one of them. An awful lot has to happen. But with Lou Piniella in charge, you can bet some good things are going to happen there for sure.
There is chaos as usual in New York. Can boss Steinbrenner hold the Yankees together as uncertainty rocks the front office over which he presides?
Yeah, I think the Yankees in this day and age where everybody has pitching shortages, including the Yankees, I'm going with the teams that I think can just slug their way through any problems. And I think the Yankees are going to slug it at a close to record pace this year. I think they're going to score 1,000 runs. That's happened once since 1950. They are absolutely devastating offensively with Bobby Abreu for a full season, Hideki Matsui for a full season. And even though there are problems in the front office, I don't think that's going to affect anything on the field. Their bigger issue is their starting pitching, which is a little banged up right now. But I think they'll get that straightened out by the end of April. And I think they'll be a very good team come October.
The team that would most relish challenging the Yankees, who you say will outslug everybody, is, of course, the Boston Red Sox. Their closer, Jonathan Papelbon, was made a starter just a short while ago because management said Papelbon's shoulder simply couldn't handle the demands of daily work as a reliever. How exactly did that shoulder change?
Well, that's my question, Bill. We were told in the offseason the shoulder can't take the constant daily throwing that a closer does, up three times, doesn't even get in a game, pitches three games in a row. The better thing to do is what John Smoltz did, give up closing, go back to the rotation where your arm has 4 days to rest. Then suddenly, when no closer emerged in spring training, suddenly it appears the doctor's recommendation was, well, he might be better off as a closer as far as shoulder health goes. So I'm a little fuzzy as to exactly what happened there. But the most important thing is the Red Sox filled a gigantic hole on their team. And they filled it with a guy who not only can do the job, but really wants to do the job. And Bill, trust me, when we're talking about players today, when it's their idea and they really want to do something, as Papelbon wants to close, they're usually more productive when they're the ones who are making the decision. And it was Papelbon who went to the Red Sox and said, if you want to put me back there, I'm ready to go.
Okay, now, finally, Tim, I recognize that you have covered your backside by saying that more teams than ever have a chance to win their divisions and get into the playoffs, but I got to ask for predictions anyway. In any order you like, give us the division winners and the World Series champ in 07.
Okay, and I want you to clip this because this one is going to be exactly right in October.
Count okay? on it.
I will be so wrong, I'm sure. Here's what I've got. I've got the Yankees, the Tigers, and the Angels winning the divisions in the American League with the Red Sox as the wild card. I have got the Mets, the Cardinals, and the Dodgers winning the divisions in the National League with the Phillies winning the wild card. I have the Yankees beating the Mets in the World Series. And I promise you, Bill, I will be so wrong about one of these picks. One team in baseball that I picked to finish fourth, whether it's Cleveland or Milwaukee or somebody, will go to the playoffs. I promise you I will miss by that much. I promise you somebody else will miss by that much. That's the beauty of the game, the unpredictable nature, and it's especially beautiful this year because this was the hardest set of picks I've ever had to make.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and joins me here at Only a Game from time to time during the season. Tim, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Tim Kirkjian knows his baseball. Everybody knows that. But should Tim desire work in another arena, like hockey, for instance, a trail has been blazed. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports.
Let's play make-believe. Pretend you're a general manager of an NHL team like, I don't know, the Minnesota Wild, and you need a new head of hockey operations. You could hire an old-timey hockey guy, you know, the kind that grew up mucking it up on frozen ponds outside of Moose Jaw or Saskatoon ever since he was a mite or a squirt. Or you can hire a beat writer from the Boston Globe, and not just any beat writer, a 24-year-old who covers baseball. Who would you pick? If you're Minnesota Wild general manager Doug Ricebrough, you'd pick Chris Snow. The Wild made that unusual move last June, but everyone in the organization thinks Chris Snow is a fine young man. Just ask Wild assistant GM Tom Lynn.
He's done a very good job. He gets up in the morning, he thinks about his job, and he goes to bed at night, he's thinking about how to make it better the next day. And I think he's been exactly as we expected, and probably even a little more so.
That still doesn't explain how Chris Snow got the job. Perhaps his former co-worker at the Globe and hockey reporter Kevin Paul DuPont could shed some light.
I think what happened was Doug Ricebrough is a sharp guy, former Montreal Canadian, who is the general manager of Minnesota. I think was just, as we all have been with Chris, impressed with his intelligence, how he carries himself, bright with a degree of humility. Probably what's less important about Chris is where he came from in terms of job, and what's most important is that he's a very engaging man and he's a very bright guy.
But hard work, intelligence, amiability, and the occasional rescue of orphan puppies from burning buildings is usually not enough to become an NHL executive. Perhaps Snow can explain best why Ricebrough and the Wild thought he was the man for the job.
I think it was another set of eyes. You know, the question then is, why my set versus somebody who's more experienced around hockey? I think he viewed my inexperience and my lack of institutional knowledge about how a hockey team is run as a plus, because he figured I could ask questions not knowing how things traditionally are done and maybe raise some good points.
Chris Snow watches his team's morning skate at Boston's TD Bank North Garden before an early March game between the Wild and the Boston Bruins. His journey to this point began at the old Boston Garden, which stood only a few hundred yards from where he's sitting. He grew up in a suburb 10 miles away and rooted for the Bruins. It's probably safe to say it's a surreal moment for a guy who at this time last year was in Fort Myers, Florida, covering Red Sox spring training.
If you had to pick the four teams in Boston, which one I grew up following the most and rooting for, it would have been the Bruins. And I was excited to come, and I came in the building and was a little nervous. It's very different. It's exciting, but so much is out of my control. You know, as a writer, you know, you're at home and you write your story, and you can stand behind what you did. And tonight, the team speaks for everything. So I'm hoping the guys play well.
Snow's newspaper career began as an intern for the Boston Globe. He spent the summer of 2001 and 2002 working with Kevin Paul DuPont in the Globe sports department. After he graduated from Syracuse University, he got his first paying job covering the Wild for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. There he got to know Rice Brow and Lynn and formed a relationship that remained strong even when Snow returned to the Globe to cover the Red Sox in 2005. The Sox had just wrapped up a world championship thanks in part to Theo Epstein, who in 2002 was made the youngest GM in Major League history at age 28. Did that spark something in Snow?
I think that over the past couple of years, especially when I left Minnesota to come back to Boston, it was in the back of my head, and very much in the back. It wasn't something that I said in a year or two or 3 years I want to make a jump like this. It was just a curiosity to me when it first was brought up in a casual conversation with Doug Risebrough a couple of years ago, and you know, I took a peek, and hopefully it's a good decision.
Lynn feels Snow has already been a boon to the Wild in at least one way.
He's of the technology generation, and he can, when we're considering a player, you know, he's pulling stuff out of technology now. It's not only statistical, but video and information on a player that we wouldn't have been able to do or even think of. And so he's kind of that next generation that's going to add more information.
That's certainly a new approach for a league that doesn't always embrace the new. DuPont says money is one thing that has forced front offices to rethink how they do business.
Traditionally, hockey has always looked from within. Typically, it hires X players and moves X players along. Players in the NHL for the last 17 to 20 years now have made very good money. This isn't like the old days when a guy, say, made $75,000 a year for a few years as a spare defenseman and then moved into minor league coaching or scouting. I think it's harder today to get players to think about coming into front offices when the average pay is around $1.6 million, $1.8 million. Frankly, they've made that money for 5 or 10 years. They really don't have to work again.
37-year-old assistant GM Tom Lynn is himself a so-called hockey outsider. He worked at a large New York law firm before he was hired by the Wild in 2000. He says that the trend of hiring from outside the old guard is already well underway.
When I first came in, I was one of the first to be kind of the outsider, the young person with a different background. And now I would say more than half the teams have someone like that in a director of hockey ops or assistant GM position. And only a few have held out to go the old way with only traditional people on staff.
If the handful of aging farm boys from Alberta and Manitoba running NHL teams are skeptical of the new league order, that doesn't seem to bother Chris Snow very much.
Ultimately, the confidence that matters to me is the confidence that Doug Risebrough and Tom Lynn and Tommy Thompson are placing me and the kind of work they give to me. And that tells me on a daily basis what's important, you know, who I need to believe in me, and the rest in time, you know, hopefully will come if I do do a good job with this.
It's impossible to say how much of an impact Chris Snow has made in only 5 months on the job. But the night he returned to the Garden, his new team beat his old team, and this week the Wild clinched a playoff berth for the first time in 4 years. No promises here, but if you're a beat writer, lawyer, or fry cook with a dream of running an NHL franchise, you might be getting a call from a former skeptic sometime this offseason. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
You're listening to Only a Game. Laura Slitt, who hears Only a Game on WEVJ in Jackson, New Hampshire, emailed with praise for Charlie Pierce, who was not impressed by Nike's new alligator skin athletic shoes. Many thanks to Charlie, she wrote. Leave the alligators alone is right. Thanks for sticking up for the animals. Richard Cowan of Buffalo, New York, was dismayed by my story last week, said in the Pittsburgh boxing gym presided over by Jimmy Civetic. I suggest that you examine the question of whether boxing is a civilized story, he wrote. It is the only sport in which the purpose is to inflict a concussion. Savetic's goal, helping youth develop productive lives, cannot justify means that aim to inflict damage to the brain. Alan Schwartz, who hears the program on WAMC, responded differently to that story. Just finished listening to the boxing segment, he wrote. It has to be the best short narrative about anything that I have ever heard or seen. From Hague, New York, Nancy and Jack Harrigan emailed to say, thanks for the provocative reviews of great sports books you discover. Taking Shots will be the fourth of your selections that we have sent to grandkids scattered around the globe. Keep those book reviews coming. Richard Burke emailed from Lenox, Massachusetts, asking for help. I have a dim recollection of a baseball game in which a batter hit the ball at the pitcher, then ran the bases while the pitcher was sprawled unconscious on the ball. Did such a thing really happen, or am I imagining it? I don't know. If you do, get in touch with us, and we'll relieve Mr. Burke's anxiety. Finally, Michelle Delfino, a WBUR listener who especially enjoyed the Mente song we played out of a conversation about Bobby Orr several weeks ago, wrote to ask, did Bill Littlefield do the voiceover for the Bengay commercial currently on the air? No. He didn't, but it was probably only because he wasn't asked. Send your questions or comments to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon. The world of news encompasses a multitude of subjects, which is why Ron Rappaport often joins me to talk about sports on Weekend Edition. You can also count on Weekend Edition to bring you political, business, and cultural news from around the non-sports world. Join Ron and me for Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
Police in Hong Kong have discovered a mechanism capable of firing darts at horses on a racecourse in that city. The remote control device, buried at the spot where the starting gate would be situated, included 12 metal 12-inch tubes. Each tube contained darts. In a leap of reasoning that has probably stunned their counterparts in cities around the globe, Hong Kong police have speculated that criminal gambling syndicates may be involved. In response to concern about the Olympic equestrian events scheduled to be held at the Hong Kong track in the summer of 2008, Lam Woon Kwang, Hong Kong's Olympic equestrian chief, called the discovery unwanted and weird, but claimed stringent arrangements were in place for the game. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, baseball's greatest booster, Buck O'Neill. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. Aren't you supposed to say where I'm at?
Well, I know you're in Atlanta, correct? And I understand there's some basketball going on down there.
Well, not yet. Not for a couple hours, and they start playing basketball down here, yeah.
I can see on the video phone that there's a splinter in your hair. There's some sawdust on your lapels there. Is that all that's left of your NCAA tournament bracket?
Oh, no, no. My brackets were an archaeological artifact 3 weeks ago.
Well, you might be interested in knowing we spoke to Pat Forty earlier today, and he picked 7 of 8 in the semis, in the Great Eight, and 4 for 4 in the Final Four.
Well, he's truly frightening, and I think Dustin Hoffman did a great job playing Pat Forty in that movie with Tom Cruise.
Charlie, we talked earlier in the program with various experts, but what do they know? Which teams do you think will come out on top in each tournament?
I think that Florida will win here. I've given up picking anything but the chalk, and I think Tennessee will win on the women's side. This year has been so enormously predictable. The most unpredictable thing that could happen in either tournament is Georgetown winning the men, so I'm just going to stay with the chalk.
Michael Ray Richardson, suspended from the NBA for drug use 21 years ago, played in Europe for years. Recently, he had been coaching in the Continental Basketball Association. Is it safe to say that further employment there seems unlikely for Richardson after this week's misadventures?
I had utterly no idea that Michael Ray Richardson was alive, much less that the last thing he said wasn't "the ship be sinking," which is probably, prior to this week, the most famous thing Michael Ray Richardson ever said. This week, he went off on a Mel Gibson tirade about Jewish lawyers and has probably demolished his career plans for the foreseeable future.
The sort of heckling to which Michael Ray Richardson had responded when he was still coaching is not unusual in basketball. Were you as surprised as Serena Williams when it turned up in tennis?
Yeah, it's a very, very strange story. She claims that somebody yelled at her from the stands at the most recent tournament, "Go to the net like a Negro." And I'm not exactly sure what that means, and neither was she, but it didn't sound good. So she was a little thrown by it.
At swimming's World Championships in Australia this week, Michael Phelps set or helped to set records day after day after day after day. The captain of the U.S. women's team, Tara Kirk, called Phelps a mutant. You think she's just jealous?
Yeah, but she said it in the nicest possible way. After a performance like that, I'm certainly sure it occurred to most people. She was just brave and open and honest enough to say it.
This week, Lorenzo Fertitta, one of the majority owners of Ultimate Fighting Championship, compared his company's acquisition of its mixed martial arts rival, Pride Fighting Championships, to the merger of the National Football League and the American Football League. So, hello, billion-dollar TV contract, right?
Hey, in a world of thugs, I'm sure he's right. But, it's better, I think, to have one umbrella organization for organized violence rather than several. So I'm very happy about this.
The Major League Baseball regular season begins tomorrow, Charlie, or so they say. I'm sure you're hoping it's just a big April Fool's joke.
I knew my heart was slowing down for some reason. I knew my metabolism was shutting down one system at a time.
In case there was any doubt, George Steinbrenner said this week, "I am the boss. I continue to be the boss." What provoked that outburst?
Well, this is a bizarre story. His son-in-law, who was reckoned to be the heir apparent to the empire, is divorcing George's daughter and therefore playing himself out of contention for the position of heir apparent, which I'm sure is exactly what it says on the door at his offices in Yankee Stadium, heir apparent. I'm sorry, I haven't seen a story like this since the Plantagenets died out. You start divorcing your queen and you lose everything.
This week, a woman umped a Major League exhibition game for the first time since 1989. So I guess we can say Commissioner Budd is right there on the cutting edge these days.
Absolutely. He's moved the league all the way back to 1989 when Pam Postema did that. I'm more interested in the fact that you just used umped as a verb.
Yeah, it's a nice verb.
It's a wonderful verb. It's not actually a verb, but it's a nice verb.
And we'll get letters. It's a good thing England managed to prevail over Andorra on Wednesday in a qualifying match for the Euro 2008 soccer finals, Charlie. Before that game, life for England's coach, Steve McClaren, was getting a little rough.
Well, he was being heckled in the London tabloids. Never a good thing. His team couldn't score, and the Sun apparently bought itself or arranged for itself their planet and called it our star and called it Planet McDonut in his honor. I would love to see Andorra play at anything because half the population of the country would be playing the game at the time.
And finally, Charlie's spring break in Florida always produces bizarre stories, some of them involving intoxicated people without pants, but not all that many of them originate in Norway.
Well, not just that. Not many of them originate in the sky. Most of them originate on the beach. Yes, a Norwegian gentleman skydived to a resounding lack of applause by the local gendarmerie, to whom he responded by mooning them. And I think that the police down there are probably used to people without pants. They're used to people with pants, but they're not used to people who arrange to be without pants spontaneously in front of them after skydiving, so they arrested him.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Baseball fulfilled me like music. I played most of my life, and I loved it. Waste no tears for me. I wasn't born too early. I was born right on time.
That's Buck O'Neill. He was the first black coach in the major leagues, but most current baseball fans knew him as the most energetic ambassador the game has ever had. O'Neill played and managed in the Negro Leagues for years in the company of such stars as Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, and Cool Papa Bell. For half a century after he left the field, O'Neill, who died in 2006 at the age of 94, traveled the world encouraging people to remember the men who'd played in the Negro Leagues. Joe Posnanski accompanied Buck O'Neill on some of his last ambassadorial journeys, and he's written The Soul of Baseball, a road trip through Buck O'Neill's America. Joe Posnanski joins me now from KCUR in Kansas City. Mr. Posnanski, welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here.
How did it happen that you found yourself traveling the country with Buck O'Neill?
Well, it was a series of things that happened. At one point a few years ago, Buck had, when you're a columnist in Kansas City, you really get to know Buck O'Neill. And we were having lunch a few years ago, and he was suggesting an idea for a book that was going to be very, very different than the way this book turned out. It was going to be more about the Negro Leagues as general thing, over time, I tried to write that book, and it was very, very difficult to write the book. There were so few Negro Leaguers still alive and so little information. And I was ready to give up on the idea. And then through a series of things, I came up with this thought of, well, what if I wrote it more about Buck and more about seeing the world, seeing the Negro League, seeing America through Buck O'Neill's eyes? And I went over to Buck one day and said, Buck, I've got this idea. Would it be okay with you if I – traveled the country with you? And Buck said, don't be late. And that's how it began.
And how much traveling did you end up actually doing with him?
Well, I think we ended up doing, I think there are 10 cities in the book, and there were probably six or seven cities that did not make the book at all. Mm-hmm. So we really traveled, and from coast to coast. I mean, you know, when we were in San Diego, we were in Seattle, we were in Atlanta, we were in New York and Boston, of course, and Chicago. So we did. We traveled all over the country and a lot in the Midwest as well. And it was amazing to see him in action no matter where we were. I mean, he was always the same guy.
Part of Buck O'Neill's mission was to tell people what it was like in the Negro Leagues. Was he surprised at how often people took it upon themselves to tell him what those days were like?
He really was, and it was something that people always wanted to project what they thought the Negro Leagues were like. And I saw that a lot. I mean, I saw a lot of people that had an idea of what the Negro Leagues were like, and the ideas were very they were varying. I mean, there were people who thought it was hard. It was nothing but agony and pain and racism and all of those things. And there were a lot of other people that thought it was just a bunch of guys clowning around. And Buck, he was really, it was important for him to try to describe what it was really like. And it was a combination of a lot of things, and it was a lot of emotions. And he always said that there never should have been a Negro Leagues, of course. But because there was one, it was a joyous and wonderful time, and he didn't know that people understood that.
Mr. O'Neill had a repertoire of stories, most of which I'm sure you've heard more times than you can count. But have you a favorite among them?
You know, it's funny. I did hear his stories a lot, and every so often he would tell a new one, and it would come from nowhere. And so my favorite story was always the one revolving around Satchel Paige and the yellow juice. And the reason was because he didn't tell it very often, and there were so many great stories. But the yellow juice was kind of an unknown story, and it comes from the time when Satchel Paige was injured. I mean, he had been hurt down in Mexico in 1939, and it looked like his career was over, and everybody had told him his career was over. And he signed on with the Kansas City Monarchs mostly as an act, basically. He would come and he would play in these games and throw for a couple of innings, and guys would swing and miss at very slow pitches. And it was just a big act for a long time. But there was a trainer with the Kansas City Monarchs at the time, and his name was Jew Baby Floyd. He would bring out all of these different sort of juices, oils, you know, and he would rub them into Satchel Paige's shoulder and try to make him better. And, of course, none of them worked. And then he pulled out the yellow juice. I would just love the yellow juice. And he brought it out, and nobody knows what it was to this day. But he rubbed it into Satchel's shoulder. And after doing this for a few days, Satchel turned to the manager of the team and said, "Turn him loose. I'm ready to go." And he was reborn and pitched for another 25 years. So there was some sort of magic in that yellow juice.
By the time you started traveling with Buck O'Neill, he was in his 90s, and it's no surprise that sometimes the demands of the travel and the long days exhausted him. Tell us a little bit about how he recharged his batteries.
It's pretty incredible. It was pretty incredible to watch. I mean, there were a couple of different ways that he would sort of recharge, and one was that he would sneak away for a little nap or try to get a few minutes of shut eye on these car rides or whatever. But my favorite way that he would do it, and I saw this over and over again, he would go and find a stranger. He would just find somebody who looked like, you know, they weren't doing anything. And he would just start talking to them. It was constant to just see him in restaurants or in hotels or in airports. I mean, he would just go up to complete strangers and say, "Hi, I'm Buck O'Neill. Well, do you remember the first time your dad took you to a game? Or do you remember what it was like for you in your first day of school?" I mean, he just had this ability to connect to people very, very quickly. And he would go into those meetings exhausted. I mean, he would just look like, how's he going to come out of this? And he would come out of them completely rejuvenated and alive and happy. And it really was amazing. It was the connection, I think, that really kept him going all those years.
Very shortly before Buck O'Neill died, a special committee named a number of Negro Leaguers to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and a great many people were disappointed and angry that Buck O'Neill himself was not among those enshrined. How did Mr. O'Neill take that news?
You know, I think that he was disappointed. There's no question. I mean, 17 Negro Leaguers went in, none of them alive. None of them really had been alive for more than a decade. I mean, even the most recent death among them was in the mid-90s. And he was thrilled for those people. But I know, and he did talk about it some, that he was disappointed. But I think what Buck felt more than anything else was that his life was about getting those Negro Leaguers honored. And there was a tremendous amount of pride that he felt that so many Negro Leaguers had gotten in. Whatever role he played in that, I think he took tremendous pride in. And he was also a guy who just never allowed disappointment to affect him. I mean, I was there with him the day that he found out that he wasn't getting in. I was there with him that moment. And within 5 minutes, he was already wondering, okay, well, who's going to speak in Cooperstown on behalf of these people, because they're all gone? Who do you think will speak? He was asking me the question, and I said, well, I don't know who's going to speak, because I was openly angry. I felt it was a terrible injustice that he didn't get in. And I said, I don't know, Buck. And Buck said, I wonder if they'll ask me to speak. And I remember just being so stunned that he could think like that. I mean, to me, why would he go speak on, you know, when they didn't vote him in, they voted these others in, but that was what Buck's life was all about, and in the end he did speak and he sang, and it was really the last public appearance that Buck made was him in Cooperstown last July when those 17 went into the Hall of Fame, and he was joyful and joyous, and you know, he was gone within 2 months, and I think that feeling of being there for those people, I think that was a tremendous amount of pride that he felt about that.
Joe, I'm very curious, having spent as much time as you did with Buck O'Neill, listening to his stories, hearing his voice, hearing him sing, do you find now that he's gone that sometimes when something will happen that might bring him to mind, you can still hear his voice?
I do. And it's funny, there are various times that for whatever reason, I'll be at an event and speaking, and there'll be somebody there that'll have a tape of Buck, and they'll play an old tape of Buck telling the Nancy story or singing or doing something. And it always catches me by surprise, not to hear his voice, but to think that he's gone. I mean, he was just one of those guys, and all of his friends talked about this. I mean, he was almost 95 when he died, and yet it was a shock. You know, you just sort of felt like this was a person that was going to live forever. And I miss him. I miss him a lot. I miss, especially when things happen, you know, getting that call from him or seeing him at the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City and just hearing his thoughts on it, because it was always surprising how he felt about whatever happened to be going on in the news or going on in baseball. And I really miss hearing that.
Joe Posnanski is the author of The Soul of Baseball, A Road Trip Through Buck O'Neill's America, published by William Morrow. Mr. Posnanski joined me from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the soul of baseball, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Buck O'Neill, who, in the face of segregation, institutional racism, and various other insults and disappointments, celebrated his blessings.
I was born right on time.
Now put him in the Hall of Fame, okay? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.